In our study of logic, Aristotle said it's the function of the wise man to know order. And I would like to define logic in terms of its contrast with the other disciplines of study on the nature of order. For example, nature, study of nature, is the order that reason discovers but does not produce. When your mind thinks about nature, you don't create nature, you discover it. But what are you discovering in nature? You're discovering an order. It is the function of the wise man to know order. When he knows order in his external environment, which he did not create, which he did not produce, and he sees that order, he understands nature. Art, on the other hand, is the order that reason produces in external things. When your reason creates an order, a form, a structure that was not there before, that's called art. So art is the order the mind produces. Nature is the order the mind discovers. Ethics is the order that reason produces in acts of the will. When you decide to do something and you do it in an orderly way, when you do it in accord with nature, that's ethics. That's an ethical act. When you do it in a disorderly, non-natural way, that's an unethical act. So ethics has to do with the order which reason produces in the acts of the will. Logic, on the other hand, is the order that reason produces in its own acts, in the very act of thinking about nature or creating a piece of art. The order that is manifest there in the reasoning process is logic. So logic is really discovering the order that reason produces in its own acts, the very acts of reasoning itself. So it's the function of the wise man to know order. If you know order out there, you know nature. If you know order that you have produced in external things, you see art. If you know order in your ethical acts, in your acts of will, you are acting morally. And if you discover the order which reason produces in its own acts, you know logic. Now we'll define logic simply as the study of right reason or valid inferences and the attending fallacies, formal and informal. Now let's break that down. The study of right reason as opposed to wrong reasoning, or valid inferences. That is, conclusions that you draw from premises or from evidence, as opposed to invalid inferences, and the attending fallacies. Some people, when they draw wrong conclusions from the premises, engender fallacies, and these fallacies have names. Some of them are formal fallacies, some of them are informal fallacies, but all of them are wrong. Now, the importance of logic. Logic in the various disciplines. It's the basis of all mathematics. Those of you who have training in mathematics, higher training in mathematics, have probably come across a book, Principia Mathematica, by Bertrand Russell, famous agnostic, and Alfred North Whitehead, who is the father of modern process theology. As a matter of fact, son of an Anglican minister and probably one of the two most influential thinkers in the 20th century. What they did in this series of books, several volume book, is demonstrate that all mathematics is based on logic, that you cannot think mathematically unless you think logically, that math is reducible to logic. So mathematics uses the fundamental rules of thought. It's also the basis of all science. Science is built normally on inductive thinking. Inductive thinking is one of the whole categories of logic. The logic of valid inferences from the general to the particular is known as deductive, and we'll discuss that later. And the logic of valid inference from the particulars to the general is known as inductive logic, and science is built on that. It's also the basis of all discourse. You can't talk. You can't communicate without logic. It's impossible to communicate unless you are utilizing the very principles of logic. Let's just take a simple illustration. One of the fundamental rules of logic is the law of non-contradiction. The thing cannot both be and not be at the same time in the same sense. That something can't be both true and false at the same time in the same sense. Another principle is the principle of identity, that A is A. A is not non-A. I am I. I am not you. Just fundamental laws like this. Now, suppose you started to make a sentence, and suppose you violated those laws, and suppose you said, all dogs have four legs. But by the time you left the word dog in the first part of the sentence, to the time you get to the words four legs in the last part of the sentence, you assume that the law of contradiction no longer holds because you left dogs. Now dogs could be cats. So when you said all dogs, or dogs could be chickens, when you said all dogs have four legs, dogs could mean chicken because dog isn't dog. Dog could be non-dog, and a chicken is a non-dog. And so you could really mean that all chickens have four legs. I mean, everything would be total nonsense if the law of non-contradiction didn't hold. You couldn't say anything meaningfully. You couldn't communicate anything. There is no discourse without these basic laws of logic. They are fundamental to everything. They're absolute, sine qua non, that without which not. So you can't talk, and needless to say, you couldn't write. You couldn't express it in writing without these basic laws of thought either, because writing is simply putting on paper what you say verbally, what you think, and therefore writing would be impossible. Or to apply it more closely to where we live, it's the basis of all exegesis. I remember, to give a good example of this, a number of years ago, I was talking with a gentleman who was dancing on the edges with regard to his commitment to inerrancy. He taught at a large seminary, and his view was quite nebulous, at least, and if not really a denial of inerrancy. The denomination had just added a statement to their creed, which read, "We believe in inerrancy of intent and fact," because the people were saying, "I believe the authors intended not to err, but they actually did err, and they were getting around it." Bultmann could have signed the original statement, Rudolf Bultmann. But then when they added the Bible is inerrant in intent, and what it intends to say as well as what it does say, fact, that made it a little tougher for them to do exegetical gyrations and get around the doctrinal statement. So I went up to this gentleman, let's call him Bob, at the annual conference. We belong to the same denomination. I said to him, Bob, what do you think of that new statement? The Bible is inerrant in intent and fact. And we discussed it a little bit, and I said, you know, you believe that there are different chronological systems used in the Synoptics and in John, don't you? Don't you believe that John contradicts the Synoptics on times and places? And he said, yes, I do. I don't think that the chronological systems are the same. And I said, well, now, wouldn't that be an error then if, let's say, John said Jesus was on the cross at 12 o'clock noon from 9 o'clock in the morning, and one of the other synoptics said some other time, wouldn't that be an error? His reply to me was, I don't press the law of non-contradiction that far. Now notice what the reply meant. The reply meant, yes, there is a factual contradiction in the Bible, but an exegete should never press the law of non-contradiction. He should just, if it says A here in John 1 and it says non-A in Matthew 3, just leave it there and just get the truth from it, but don't try and reconcile it. Don't try and say they must be non-contradictory. The Bible may say totally different things in different places. Just exegete the text and don't try and systematize it. You systematic theologians are always trying to systematize everything. Your harmonistic attempts are forgetting the exegetical nuts and bolts of the text, his exact phrase. Now, when he analyzed what he was saying the law of non-contradiction does not apply to the results of exegesis. You can conclude A from this passage and non-A from this passage, and they could both be true even though they're in some sense contradictory. How so? Just don't press the law of non-contradiction that far. Another example of the same thing, Dr. Kenneth Conser, former dean of Trinity Seminary and editor of Christianity Today, was taking a course under Karl Barth a number of years ago. And Barth was notorious for his paradoxical thinking and for his belief that God transcends logic. And he was pontificating in his class one day about how God is transcendent and sovereign above all things, including human logic. And Dr. Conser brought him a series of syllogisms that Barth had apparently used in his dogmatics. And he said, look, here on the Trinity you have a syllogism. And a syllogism is a major and a minor premise from which you draw a conclusion, something like God is one, there are three persons who are called God, therefore God is three and one. He had syllogisms like that in his dogmatics. And Conser said, here, you're using logic. And Barth's reply was, translated into English, quote, I use logic when it helps me, end quote. Well, now, unfortunately, you can't do that. Unfortunately, you can't use logic just when it helps you. You must use logic all of it. You must use logic when you reject logic. Logic is literally undeniable. You've got to use it in your exegesis. You have to use it in your hermeneutics. The next point here, you can't think hermeneutically without the laws of logic. In fact, all of the basic principles of hermeneutics are reducible to one or more of the principles of valid inference, whether deductive or inductive. Hermeneutics is not another category. It's a category that derives all of its weight and force from logic. And the person who is the good hermeneutician is the person who knows the laws of logic best and can apply them correctly. It's the basis of all biblical theology. Ever since von Rad, particularly in Old Testament studies and others in New Testament studies, people don't even talk systematic theology. I remember a number of years ago I was on an examining committee at a seminary examining a potential professor in theology. And one of the questions they asked him is, what do you think of systematic theology? As opposed, of course, to exegesis and biblical theology and historical theology and the other categories of theology. His response was one of bewilderment, both to himself and to us. With a blank look on his face, he said, systematic. Does anybody call it that anymore? Now, what he was reflecting is a whole trend, a whole movement in the last couple generations where people don't think systematically. Exegesis, yes. Biblical theology, that's good stuff. But systematic theology, what is that? Systematic theology is just thinking logically about the results of the other studies, like exegesis and biblical theology and historical theology, and putting it all together. Systematic theology is simply logical thinking about the results of the data that you get from your biblical studies. Systematic theology is not a bad term. And one of the reasons people don't like systematic theology is because you can manipulate the text easier if you don't think logically about it than if you do think logically about it. Compare biblical seminary. Biblical seminary, you would think, would be an orthodox seminary, wouldn't you? With a name like that and with a stress on biblical theology, it's liberal. How did they start? They started by a repudiation of classical systematic theology and thinking logically, and then began to do their own thing through the text and to make it putty or plastic rather than following the necessary categories of thought. Also, logic is the basis for all apologetic thinking. Some people think that you have to be a classical apologist rather than a presuppositional apologist in order to use logic. Classical apologetics stresses arguments for the existence of God, the validity of historical evidence. B.B. Warfield was a classical apologist, whereas presuppositional apologetics, like Van Til and others, stresses presuppositions that you cannot argue from evidence to God, or you cannot reason and prove the existence of God. And the people who believe in presuppositional apologetics generally give you the impression, and some of them do, reject Aristotelian logic, reject the basic categories of thought that were. They say logic is just for classical apologetists, not for presuppositionalists. Well, let's analyze that for a moment. Suppose you were a presuppositionalist and you wanted to express your view. Suppose your view was something like this. My basic, irreducible, non-provable presupposition is the triune God exists and has revealed himself in the Bible. Van Til, for example, that's where he begins. Now, suppose we take that statement and we say, is that statement non-contradictory? If it's contradictory, can't be true. If it's non-contradictory, that very statement uses the law of non-contradiction. Or let's take the principle of identity, A is A. Does that statement mean what it means, or does it mean what it doesn't mean? If A isn't A, the statement could mean what it doesn't mean. So you can't even express, even a presuppositionalist, and I'm not arguing which apologetic system is true or false here, I'm just saying everybody, presuppositionalists and non-presuppositionalists, have to use logic. Their Van Til's books are filled with syllogisms, filled with logical things. He was a brilliant man. He knew how to think logically, and his book is filled with examples of it, despite the fact that from time to time he will debunk the use of Aristotelian logic. He used it. He had to use it. So did Barth. There is no way to avoid it, because logic is literally undeniable. Now, not only is all apologetic thinking based on logic, but all thinking is based on logic. Aristotle used to have fun with his skeptical friends. If they didn't believe anything, Aristotle would usually ask them, "Do you exist?" And they had three alternatives. One is to say, "Yes, I do exist." And that, of course, meant that they were not total skeptics. They knew something. At least they knew they existed. Two, they could say, "No, I don't exist." And, of course, that was self-defeating, because they had to exist in order to say, "I don't exist." So that was not too happy a situation for them. Or they had a third alternative, and that is to say nothing. That view is called mutism. Just remain mute. Now, the consistent skeptic became a mutist. On the other hand, this consistent mutist can't think either, because if he sits there and thinks to himself, "I exist or I don't exist," he's using logic. If he thinks he does, then A is A. If he thinks he doesn't, when he does, then he is contradicting himself. In any event, he can't even think clearly. So you'd have to not think at all, not speak at all, and certainly not write at all to be consistent with the view of the total skeptic. All thinking is based on logic. Everything is based on logic. Now, I'd like to go back to our original statement. The original statement we began with was this. It's not in the notes. Quoted from my logic professor. The next best thing to godliness for a Christian is logic. I would like to suggest that's wrong. It's not strong enough. That logic is on the same level with godliness. It's not the next best thing. That logic and godliness are correlative for this reason. You can't even define, let alone perform, an ethical action unless you're using the law of non-contradiction or the law of identity. Let's take an example. This is good and that is evil. Get down to basics. This is good and that is evil. What is that? Well, you're using right there a distinction built on the law of non-contradiction. An act of love cannot at one and the same time be an act of non-love. It's either love or not love. It can't be both love and hate, for example, simultaneously. So you're using the law of non-contradiction. In fact, when you say love, you mean love is love. You don't mean love is non-love. You don't mean love is hate. So logic is not the next best thing to godliness. Logic and godliness are correlative. To be godly, you must be logical. You cannot be godly if you're not logical. So don't put it one step down. In fact, let's even go one step up. God is logical. It's not God and then logic. It's logic inside of God. God is consistent, self-consistent. God is identical to himself. God thinks clearly and correctly. So it's not God and then logic. It's logic and God on the same level. And when it's expressed on the lower level, it's not godliness or logic. It's godly logic and logical godliness. I believe that all of the attributes of God ought to be hyphenated. For example, God is not holiness and love. He is holy love and loving holiness. And in the same sense, God is rational. Everything that he is rational because he's a rational being. But he's moral. But he's rational morality and moral rationality. It's not one or the other. He is both. I can't think of anything that's more important to counteract the New Age movement, to bring it right back to where we live today, which is the major movement going on in the world today, than logic. The most fundamental fallacy of all New Age thought is that reality goes beyond the laws of logic. That's the most fundamental fallacy. You can talk about everything else, you know, the peace movement and meditation and holistic health and all these other fascinating things about the New Age movement. But their fundamental principle is reality goes beyond the laws of logic. The yin-yang, or the two sides of the force, the good and the evil, in God, he is the coincidence of opposites, to borrow a term from Meister Eckhart, the great mystic. All of that is denying that the laws of logic apply to the very nature of God. All right, let me stop there and see if there's any question now on the first two points, definition of logic and the importance of logic. Any question, comment?
I don't know if this is premature, Prof, but when it comes to the mysterious in the Christian faith, like I think the Trinity, or the fact that God, who is one, who is eternal, has no beginning and end, died on the cross, don't we have to acknowledge that in some sense our faith is reasonable, but it's not rational?
Okay, we'll address that question later this morning, so I'll pass on. But the brief answer is no. And the reason for the no I'll give in about a half hour or so.
Could you briefly discuss systematic theology just a little further in contrast to the other
reasons? Yeah, well, systematic theology as opposed to, let's say, biblical theology. Biblical theology takes the categories as they are expressed in the Bible. Systematic theology takes all of the various topics in the Bible and puts them together in a rational, coherent way with categories that are not as they are expressed in the Bible. For example, the doctrine of the Trinity obviously is a rational way of putting together biblical truth. Nowhere in the Bible, 1 John 5, 7 not being in the Bible, does it even say there are three persons in one God. But who is going to deny the doctrine of the Trinity? The only person who's going to deny it, seems to me, is a person who either doesn't believe what the Bible is teaching or doesn't believe that you should systematize what the Bible is teaching. Another example would be, if you take categories as they are expressed in exegesis, and if you look only for the main idea of the passage, the big idea, my contention is that the big idea of no passage in the Bible is to teach anything about angels. Angels are always brought in tangentially. And find any single passage in the Bible which the main idea was to teach you something about angels. That would mean if you followed that category and didn't systematize that there would be no such thing as angelology or demonology. It's because angelology and demonology are taking all the truths tangentially mentioned, systematizing them under one category, angels or demons, and getting the resulting truth. And you could do havoc with, I'd say, easily 90% of systematic theology would have to go, if not 95%, if you did only exegesis and only biblical theology. Systematic theology takes the results of all of that, and for that matter, historical studies too. And if you follow Lewis Berry Chafer, which I do, he says take all the results not only of biblical revelation, but of general revelation as well. And take all the truths you learn from nature, Romans 1, 19 and 20, Romans 2, 12, Psalm 19, 1, and you put those together and systematize it with biblical theology, then you have systematic theology. So it's the queen of the sciences. Any other thought, question?
Why did Wright get the co-author of this book, Principia Mathematica, and then develop this process in physics, which is a repudiation of logic?
Yes, that's a good question. Whitehead showed, along with Russell, that all of math is reducible to logic. But when he came to doing his own systematic theology, which we call metaphysics in philosophy, Whitehead, or at least one of his disciples, said this about Whitehead's inconsistency. He said, Whitehead never hesitated to put consistency above comprehensiveness, which was another way of saying if he couldn't make it consistent, at least he threw it all in the pile. Even if he couldn't put all the pieces together, at least he had all the pieces there. Comprehensiveness was one of the crucial tests of truth. And it seems like he put comprehensiveness over consistency, and in so doing, didn't hesitate to have incoherencies in his system, which we would call contradictions. That's the best I can put after studying Whitehead for years and trying to make sense out of, for example, his concept of God. Is God has two sides, a finite side and an infinite side. If you look at the attributes of God, they're mutually exclusive. He says, well, there are two poles to God, two ends, a finite and an infinite, a temporal and a non-temporal one, an unchanging one, a changing one. Well, the inconsistency of the system blows your logical mind. How can someone with such a brilliant mind do that? The only answer that I know is it's a whole lot easier looking back to find people's errors than it is looking in to find people's errors. We can look back and say, well, look at Aristotle. Boy, that was terrible for a brilliant mind to do that, you know. And look at Augustine. Well, that was real dumb to say that. But it won't take 200 years or 2,000 for people to look back and say, well, look at that dumb thing Geisler just said there. That's, you can see that today. You know, if it takes 1,000 years or so to recognize that, then that's pretty good record. Objections to logic. There are a number of objections to using logic the way we just suggested in mathematics and science and all discourse and writing and thinking and hermeneutics and theology. One of them is that there are many kinds of logic, and why choose Aristotelian Western logic? There's Eastern logic and Western logic, and there's symbolic logic and non-symbolic logic, and inductive logic and deductive logic, all kinds of logics. Why choose this rationalistic, Aristotelian, Western logic? Your prejudice, your bias, your cultural blinders are showing. The response is that the basic laws of logic are not arbitrary but necessary. The assumption of the question is that you're choosing one kind rather than another, and that this is an arbitrary choice. But the basic laws of logic are not arbitrary, they're absolutely necessary. They're literally undeniable. You cannot deny the law of non-contradiction without using the law of non-contradiction in your denial. Now, I want to stop here and show how we, quote, prove logic, end quote. This is our proof for logic. The proof is that you cannot affirm it without affirming it, and you cannot deny it without affirming it. So whether you affirm it or deny it, you affirm it. That's the proof. Examples. I cannot speak a word in English. What's wrong with that? I cannot speak a word in English. You just did. is your response, right? Now, what your response is saying, really, is that is a self-refuting affirmation. It refutes itself. In philosophy, we call this self-stultification. That if in the process of affirming it, you deny it, or in the process of denying it, you affirm it, it self-destructs in midair. It pulls the carpet out from under itself. It cuts its own throat. I cannot speak a word in English is wrong because I spoke a word in English in the very process of telling you I couldn't do it, I did it. So I destroyed. I don't exist is another one. I'd have to exist in order to say I don't exist. So it's self-refuting. Now that same kind of logic applies to the law of non-contradiction. Let's suppose I say the law of non-contradiction is not true. Then you have to ask, what about it? What about this whole statement? Suppose the law of non-contradiction does not apply to this statement. Then L could mean non-L. So it could mean not logical is not true. Or it could mean non-T. It could be logic is not true. In other words, these statements don't have to remain consistent because the law of non-contradiction doesn't hold. Well, now, if that were so, then the statement itself wouldn't make any sense. Because once the terms of the statement are not subject to the law of non-contradiction, they can mean something else than they mean. Take the statement, God exists. And say the law of non-contradiction doesn't apply. Then exists could mean not exist. Because the law of non-contradiction says you can't both exist and not exist at the same time. If the law of non-contradiction isn't true, you could exist and not exist at the same time in the same sense. Then God exists could mean God does not exist. And that statement, God exists, could mean exactly the opposite. Or take any other ethical statement like, love is the greatest good. If that statement, love is the greatest good, is not subject to the law of non-contradiction, then love could mean not loving is the greatest good. So the absurdities that result from denying the law of non-contradiction, including the self-referential, or that is self-defeating absurdity, is great. Let's take one more example. Let's take Van Til as an example. Logic does not apply to reality. Logic does not apply to ultimate reality. It doesn't matter whether you put a little U there, ultimate reality or just reality. There is some logic, a reality to which logic does not apply. Now, what's wrong with that statement? Logic does not apply to ultimate reality, which in his system equals God. What's wrong with the statement? That logic does not apply to ultimate reality. That's right. It's a logical statement about ultimate reality. Let's take logic here to mean the law of non-contradiction. The law of non-contradiction does not apply to ultimate reality. The problem with that is a non-contradictory statement. If you went to Van Til and you said, is this statement contradictory? Logic does not apply. No, I don't make contradictory statements. I'm making meaningful statements. I'm making true statements. That's a true statement for Van Til. It's true, it's consistent, it's non-contradictory. So he's got a non-contradictory statement saying that non-contradiction doesn't apply to ultimate reality. He's got to use the law of non-contradiction in the very process of saying it doesn't apply to ultimate reality. While he's denying it of ultimate reality, he is affirming it of ultimate reality. Or another way to put it, instead of picking on Van Til, let's pick on the New Age people. Logic does not apply to the, and you can fill in whatever you want here, to the Tao, to the force, to the power, to Brahman. It doesn't matter, you know, et cetera, whichever your religious background is. Logic does not apply to the Tao. Well, that statement, logic does not apply to the Tao, is a logical statement about the Tao. The ultimate reduction, if it's not a logical statement about the Tao, is either it's totally meaningless statement about the Tao, it's a contradictory, totally meaningless statement, and neither reality nor anything I say, including whatever a Buddhist writes, is totally meaningless or is not making any truth claim at all. In fact, when Alan Watts, who is probably one of the most popular New Age writers before New Age was even a popular term among evangelicals, an Episcopal minister who became enthralled with Eastern thought and has kind of amalgamated Eastern and Western thought. When Alan Watts was pressed about his books, in which he says this very same thing, that ultimate reality is not subject to logic and to truth claims, when he was pressed, saying, well, then why do you write books? It's a good question. Because the assumption usually behind writing a book or giving a speech is, I have some meaningful truth to convey to you, and I'd like to share it with you, and you get it, and you study it over, and you see whether it's true or not. That's the assumption behind a rational discourse and communication. So it's a very basic question to ask a pantheist, a New Ager, why he writes books. Alan Watts' response was, he really only has two basic responses to get out of. One is that he's writing books to communicate truth, non-contradictory truth, which we can understand, but if he said that, he'd have to give up his view, because his view is that there are no non-contradictory truths about ultimate reality that we can understand. His other response would have to be something like this, and here's what he said. I write books because that's my thing. That's my thing. Birds fly and authors write books. But you see, that won't fly. That won't fly. Why? Because that boils down to either I am making no truth claims in my book whatsoever, or I am making truth claims in my book. If I am making truth claims in my book, then he's right back to self-defeating statement, because he says you can't make truth claims about reality, ultimate reality anyway. If he says I am making no truth claims in my book at all, then why read it? Why write it? Even if he writes it, anyone who reads it, especially if he pays money for it, is really dumb, because the presupposition is there'll be something worthwhile here. There'll be some truth or some aspect of truth that you can get to. If you knew up front, if the author put on the first page of the book, I have discovered no truth, reality, or good in whatsoever, and nothing in this book will convey any truth, any reality, or any good whatsoever, and I'm making no claim for it, who would read past that page? The point is that logic either applies to reality or it doesn't. If it applies to reality, they're self-defeating. If it doesn't, they're not making any coherent, consistent, meaningful statement whatsoever. So don't let people give you paranoia by saying, well, as Aristotelian Western rationalistic logic. Logic is logic, and the laws of logic are undeniable. All systems of logic are based on the basic laws of logic. Aristotle did not invent logic, he only helped discover it. And we have a whole appendix on Aristotle, Appendix 1 in the back, we'll not look at the present time, but just let me point out that Aristotle did not create logic. He was simply the first brilliant Western mind to record his orderly thoughts about logic. There may have been people who thought the same ones before Aristotle, and they weren't recorded and preserved. But to our knowledge, Aristotle is the first great systematic logical thinker who saw these laws, who wrote them down and put them in the book, and we still have copies of the books to this day. I would go so far as to say this, that Aristotle was probably the greatest mind that ever lived, the greatest finite mind on the face of the earth. He was a pagan. Certainly was the greatest systematic mind from the ancient world. And I don't know anybody in the modern world or the medieval world that was greater than Aristotle. There were some great systematic minds. When you think that Aristotle was the first person to do this, I mean, you and I can read this and say, oh, that's wonderful, but there are hundreds of people before. But when he was just, there he is with his mind, and there's reality surrounding him, and Aristotle puts this all together and writes books that are still valid to this day. His basic books on logic and refutation and logical thinking are still valid to this day, and the basic principles of them are used in this course and in every course of logic that's taught anywhere. And he's been dead now for 2,300 years. It's a brilliant, brilliant mind. Most of what we're doing today, I can't think of hardly anyone alive who will have any more than a footnote of their view in somebody else's book 2,000 years from now. 2,000 years from now, we'll all be wiped out and be lucky to make a footnote in somebody's book. Aristotle's books are still being used. The guy was absolutely brilliant. And the second greatest mind, in my opinion, ever lived is Thomas Aquinas. He was like a Christian Aristotle. He lived from 1224 to 1274, and he had a systematic mind that wouldn't stop. He wrote, in his lifetime, 98 books. One of the books is over 60 volumes long, Summa Theologica, on the shelf there. He took all of the research of Albert the Great, who was an encyclopedist, who just gathered everything there, and he systematized it. You can always see farther standing on the shoulders of someone else, and you can see much farther standing on the shoulder of a giant. You must begin your thinking. I would say end it, but you must begin your systematic thinking as a Christian with Thomas Aquinas, because he's the greatest systematic thinker that Christianity has ever produced. If you want to go beyond him, fine. But to go around him shows what a small mind you are, because he was one of the greatest Christian minds that ever lived.